This is Spectrum.
Alternative Myth, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO, Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. This is Scott Jordan here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Hey, Scott, how are you?
I'm good.
Well, tonight we have a spectacular guest. He is the founder and president of the Mars Anomaly Research Society. He's a team leader of Project Pegasus. He's a lawyer, a writer, a scholar, and a 21st century visionary. He's an emerging figure in the truth movement, leading campaign to lobby the U.S. government to disclose such controversial truths as the fact that Mars harbors life, that the U.S. has achieved quantum access to past and future events. His paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, published back in 2008, was the first work to prove that Mars is an inhabited planet. He is also one of America's early time space explorers. In the late 60s and early 70s, he was a child participant in the time space exploration program of the U.S. Defense Technical Community Project Pegasus. In that capacity, he was the first American child to teleport and took part in probes and past and future events, utilizing time travel technologies, then being researched and developed by DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. For over 10 years, Andy has investigated his experience in Project Pegasus on a quest to prove them and communicate them to others. Welcome, Andrew Bisciago. Hi, Andy. How are you?
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Scott. It's good to be on with you.
And thanks for coming. Wow, that's quite a resume you've got there. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about just a bullet point of the. I think we've pretty much covered your history, but maybe you can give us a bullet point version of it.
Well, I grew up in New Jersey and attended a public elementary school in North Central New Jersey, and from a very young age, I was brought into the secret activities of the U.S. Defense Technical Community. These would be the government agencies and private defense contractors that were developing weapons and intelligence gathering devices for the U.S. president, intelligence community, and military. My father was a distinguished aerospace engineer who had worked on a number of classified aerospace projects in the 1950s before my birth in 1961. So at a very young age, beginning actually in the summer of 1967, which was the summer after my kindergarten school year, I was brought into Project Pegasus, which was the emerging time-space exploration program of the U.S. government. So my dad began to take me to different defense contractor locations that would be significant in the program that was unfolding and that they had already... There had been a determination to involve me in as I was going through my elementary school years in New Jersey. Today, I'm on the other side of the country. I'm a trial lawyer in Washington State. But I spent the last 10 years really going back and trying to essentially prove what happened to me, and I've done so. I've gathered hundreds of facts related to the people, the places, the technologies, and the experiences that I had as a child time traveler in Project Pegasus. And I hope to publish my book about both my experiences as a child and then the quest I went on as an adult to prove that Project Pegasus existed and that I was in it and involved time travel. And I expect that book to come out in the middle of next year. So at this point, I'm simply sharing my experiences so that the people of the world know the truth, which is that time travel, different forms of time travel, were developed secretly by the United States government over 40 years ago. And we need to find out what was accomplished and what's been done since, because there are profound implications in terms of transportation, in terms of privacy, in terms of the geopolitical balance of power, in terms of where our energy infrastructure should be going, our transportation infrastructure. So right now I've been involved here for several years simply giving an account of what happened. It was highly peculiar, but at this point, I knew long before I launched my public campaign that what I had remembered being part of as a young child had actually happened. And during my quest to prove what happened, I was successful. I for example, gathered statements from project principals about the project. And so that's what I'm doing now is simply talking about what happened so that we can bring the world up to speed about these critical facts and then go about the business of determining what we should do with these time travel technologies once they begin to become declassified.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to be honest with our listeners and say I've been following Andrew's story for a couple of years now. I'm quite familiar with it. But there's always questions and details and things that you can tweak out of a story. I've heard interviews where you've added context to things that was broader context and more information. So I think that's what we're going to try and do here today, if that's okay with you, Andrew.
Certainly is.
Okay. I have a question about, and this is going to seem a little left field, but I would like to know the difference, if there is one, between the coronavisor, plasma confinement, Bordel tunnel, and the quantum plenum.
Okay. Well, the first three are time travel technologies. Plasma confinement was the most advanced and esoteric form of time travel that I was involved in. I was only involved in several time probes using that methodology.
Mm-hmm.
The plasma confinement was a form of quantum access in which plasma was placed under confinement in a lucite chamber, basically a big glassine chamber that was about twice the size of a squash court. And we walked into, we entered the chamber was closed. We walked into the plasma that we could see hovering at the end of the chamber with all these beautiful neon colors.
Mm-hmm.
And we had been instructed that when we walked past the line on the floor into that field of plasma, we would start, basically, we would have a dropping sensation, and we would find ourselves shooting through the quantum plenum, which is this amber-colored realm that undergirds the holographic realm that we live in and call reality.
Right.
There is a foundation to the time-space continuum, and that is the quantum plenum. When I did that, I found myself not only having the sensation of falling, but of going through this cascading series of branching wormholes through the quantum plenum. That was the only time when I was involved in any of the eight forms of quantum access that I was exposed to in Project Pegasus when I actually encountered wormholes, as depicted, let's say, in a film like What the Bleep Do We Know.
Mm-hmm.
When that transit through those wormholes ended, I found myself where they had sent me. For example, the trip that I took in the spring of 1972 to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, with the express purpose of trying to watch or observe President Abraham Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address on November 19th of 1863. I reached Gettysburg on that day via plasma confinement. The plasma confinement chamber that I entered was in a time lab in East Hanover, New Jersey, under the direction of Dr. Sterling Colgate, who during those years was the director of the New Mexico Institute of Science and Technology. He went on to a distinguished career in astrophysics at the Los Alamos National Labs. So he was, in a sense, the pioneer of plasma confinement. And in fact, during my, that was my second fact-finding trip to New Mexico in September of 2004, I went into the research library at New Mexico Tech and pulled out a newspaper article in which it was reported that Dr. Sterling Colgate of New Mexico Tech will be giving a lecture tonight on plasma confinement, and it bore a 1972 date. So that was one of the technical dimensions of the project that I linked up during my fact-finding. The chronovisors were an earlier technology in which Two Vatican musicologists named Ernetti and Gemelli were studying the harmonic patterns in Gregorian chants in the 1940s at the Catholic University of Milan. And as they were fine-tuning a specialized microphone to split the voices in the chants, something that Father Gemelli's father had said to him in childhood came through the microphone, and they realized that they had essentially identified the collapsed signal, a past event, and brought it into the present. And so working with Enrico Fermi, by 1952, they had a two-dimensional form of chronovision, something that looked like a TV set, a TV image. When I was first exposed to the chronovisors in Project Pegasus, beginning in fall of 1970, now almost 20 years after Ernetti and Gemelli and Fermi had actually modeled a two-dimensional chronovisor image, I was exposed to moving three-dimensional images. Well, first, actually, I was shown the signing of the U.S. Constitution, and that was in a two-dimensional framework. But then when we were brought into the laboratories where the most modern chronovisors were being experimented with, we entered a room where we could see what looked like a cubical form of cinema. What they were doing was driving an electromagnetic signal through an octagonal crystal array of bismuth, which is element 83. And the significance of bismuth is that it has a complete proton shell and then one additional proton. And in discussions with modern time travel developers, we were theorizing that bismuth was used in the chronovisors because it catches that residual signal and then drives it through that proton shell and amplifies it. As my father said to me, I said, how is it working, Dad? How is it possible for them to set up these three-dimensional cinema-like images of past and future events so that we can see them in New Jersey in 1970? And he said, when we drive the EM signal through the bismuth, it has a lensing effect, like a magnifying glass. The chronovisor is an electro-optical device that brings that residual signal going on somewhere else in the quantum hologram, in the time-space continuum, identifies the signal, amplifies it, and then lenses it into the laboratory.
That's interesting.
Okay, so that's a technical remote viewing device when you're looking at the hologram. That's a window to a past or future event.
Right.
But if I might just complete this description. Because
yeah, no,
what
absolutely.
They found is that when somebody stood in the hologram, they not only saw what was going on, they experienced being there. So they found that this electro-optical device that they originally thought would only have significance as a technical remote viewing device was in fact a form of time machine.
Okay. Now, I know of a book, Father Ernetti's Chronovisor, A Creation and Disappearance of the World's First Time Machine by Peter Crassa. Do you know if that detail is in there, about the bismuth? I'm just curious.
No, I'm sharing details. I'm familiar with Peter Crass's book. In fact, I read it during my investigation. The first chapter contains facts that are relevant to the provenance of the chronovisor. The rest of the book is full of a lot of metaphysical writing that's almost irrelevant in terms of the whole time travel field. Mm-hmm. But it does contain some of the biographical information about Ernetti and Gemelli. I remember reading that data when we were being trained on Project Pegasus. No, I'm sharing data that I gleaned in asking questions of my father, who was one of the project engineers,
right,
and that was in the learning component about the chronovisors on the speed learning machines that they put us on to train us, which were called tachistoscopes, which had been designed by the Office of Naval Research and constructed at one of my dad's former employers, which was the Thomas A. Edison Research Labs in East Orange, New Jersey. I'm fairly certain, based on the fact that they were educating us in the actual, you know, origins, structure, function, and effects of the different time travel devices, that basic account involving those two Vatican musicologists was in fact the derivation of the chronovisor. As Ernetti said, every human being from birth to death traces an arc of light and sound in the quantum hologram. And I think that's a pretty eloquent statement of the of what metaphysics or different ancient belief systems like Hinduism refer to as the Akashic Record. Essentially, everything that has happened, is happening, or will happen is stored on a multi-dimensional basis in the multiverse. And I think people have a human right to know that. That means essentially that we should be moral creatures, not merely because it's the right thing to do, but because everything we do is being recorded from birth to death in this dimension and in others. So the chronovisor was first thought of as just something that would provide a window to the past. That's what it was doing when it was rendered in two dimensions. I mean, I mentioned seeing George Washington and Benjamin Franklin at the signing of the U.S. Constitution on September 17th, 1787 in Philadelphia. But then after we were trained on that component of the program, we were actually being immersed in these holograms and suddenly finding ourselves in primarily past but some future locations. Now, that was what I call a physio-virtual form of time travel. It wasn't entirely physical, nor was it entirely virtual and sort of a simulation of, let's say, a past event. It was actual time travel to that event, but when we went there, specialized effects were occurring. Like, we were trained in the fact that from the perspective of human beings and other sentient, you know, creatures in that location, the time-space continuum, we were only a spectral presence, just as, let's say, ghosts are in our time-space environment. In fact, that's what Jack Pruitt said when he was training us on the chronovisors. He said, look, if a dinosaur steps on you or a Viking passes a sword through your midsection, you will not be killed because you're not fully there. You're there as sort of a superluminal superimposition on that location in the time-space continuum. And that was necessary because the third form of actual time travel that they were using to actually relocate us in the time-space continuum was simply Tesla teleportation, where they were setting up a field of radiant energy, and we were jumping through that curtain of light, this radiant energy that Nikola Tesla had been working with since 1899 in Colorado Springs. And when we did so, we found ourselves physically moving through a vortal tunnel in the time-space continuum. And when that tunnel would close, we were somewhere else. So when I talk about being in Santa Fe, you know, being in Los Alamos, in Albuquerque, I wasn't just there as a superluminal superimposition. I was physically there. We were jumping through tunnels that this Tesla device was opening up in the time-space continuum. We would find ourselves in this illuminated tunnel. If you look quickly to the left or right, we could see this profusion of alternate scenarios going on. And then when the light at the end of the tunnel suddenly hit us, we would find footfall in New Mexico, and then we were jumping back in a similar way back to New Jersey. So there were three different forms of quantum access. Quantum access is not time travel. Quantum access is something broader than that. Quantum access includes time travel, and it includes all forms of remote viewing where you're not physically visiting a past or future location. You're propagating an image of a past or future location so that you can either observe it or experience being there without physically being there. But certainly plasma confinement and Tesla teleportation involved physically going to a past or future location. And then people say to me, well, how did you get home if you were going there physically? Well, in the case of the teleporters, we couldn't teleport to a time before the existence of the program because there weren't teleporters to get us home, to get us back to the present. So we would have been stranded in the past, for example. There was also a concern that we might be lost in time, so we had some specialized training if that happened. In the case of plasma confinement, they sent me to Gettysburg in 1863. In that case, the quantum field effect that the plasma confinement had generated around us to sort of push us into a different location would wear off. I've used the term evanesce. It would sort of transiently fade. And we would have this massive kundalini sensation as if every cell in our body was being fired. And when we came out of that sort of perusure, whatever you call it, that sort of dissociative state of having a massive kundalini rush or sensation, we were back in the time lab in East Hanover. Right. So there were really different forms of quantum access. Certainly Tesla teleportation and plasma confinement involved real time travel. I mean, I was always experiencing a kind of a gnawing sense of anxiety that I might be stranded in the past. And
well, that would be a worry, wouldn't it?
And if you when you go into the past physically, right? Something, let's say you change something in the past, what will happen?
Well, what happens is you change that timeline and it branches off into another timeline. So, for example, people often ask me, well, what if you go back and interact with yourself? Everybody has the notion that you become yourself. You kind of fuse with yourself when you did something in the past. And I think that's kind of the misinforming legacy of the linear, sort of no threshold kind of conception of time travel that was created by H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine. When you time travel, you don't go through time faster or slower. You go from one point in time to another. Okay, so for example, if you visited yourself in the past, you would be an older version of yourself visiting a younger version of yourself. Just like if a clone met the person that he or she was cloned from. They're basically identical twins separated by time, right? Well, that's what happens when you go back from the future back to yourself in the past. So that if, for example, you tell yourself to avoid some danger, like let's say an accident that you're going to be into that affects your destiny, what happens is when you alter the present for that version of yourself in your past, a timeline branches off because you've now intervened in the causation of your life in the past. And so that version of you inherits or moves forward and experiences a destiny that results from the intervention that you did from the future. But when you return to your own future, you're the person who left. So you're on another timeline where you went on this humanitarian mission and set the world right from the perspective of you in the past, but that caused a branching off into another timeline. And that's expressed in what quantum physicists talk of as the example of Schrodinger's cat. When a cat decides to jump in or out of a box, another version of that cat does something else on another timeline. It decides to jump away from the box, not in the box. Or it decides to stay in the box rather than jump out of the box. In other words, every time you intervene to alter the direction of causation on a given timeline, it branches off into the timeline that the time traveler was on originally and the timeline affected by the intervention.
So you could potentially change whatever, but it will not affect our time frame.
Correct. In fact, maybe I can use this as another example because this is one of the strangest things that happened when I was attached to Project Pegasus. My father and I, in the fall of 1971, teleported from the Curtiss Wright Aeronautical Company facility in Woodridge, New Jersey, where that teleport we were using was located, to Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is the collection area they were using. And my dad dropped off some military plans up at the Los Alamos National Labs that he'd been given back in New Jersey. And when we went down to, after that mission that we were on, when we went down to take lunch at the La Hacienda restaurant in Albuquerque where his longtime friend Connie Chavez worked, he called me over to Connie's location in the restaurant and said, Andy, tell Connie what year it is. And I walked over to her table and said, what do you mean, Dad? It's 1971, isn't it? And Connie literally fell off her chair. Because from her perspective, it was the beginning of the summer of 1973. And that I had a disquieting sense about that because here I now realize, my God, they're not just setting us backward or forward in time a few hours, but now that the project has been in existence for several years, they've now found a way to jump us forward in time as much as a year and a half. And I became quite disquieted about the fact that my father and I were going to be spending the whole summer there and then jumping back to the fall of 1971. I actually cried myself to sleep when I realized that the first night up at the rental house in White Rock, New Mexico. But my dad said, look, when you stop crying, son, you know, come out of your room and I'll explain it. You'll have nothing to worry about. And he created a timeline, and he showed that when we jumped back to New Jersey at the end of that summer of 1973, we would not just be going back to New Jersey in real time, but back to New Jersey on the day that we left. So my mother and my brothers and sisters would not be concerned about my absence from their perspective.
Right, from their perspective, you wouldn't be gone for 3 years.
I wouldn't be gone at all. Not for 3 years, but I wouldn't be gone for a phantom summer of 73 in New Mexico, because from their perspective, we went to the hardware store, not Curtiss Wright, And we came back from the hardware store when, in fact, we spent the whole our little jaunt to the hardware store, you know, sandwiched within it was a whole summer of 1973 spent in White Rock. But I was still, so I calmed down substantially, but I was still concerned about the fact that I was away from home. I was homesick, quite frankly, and pretty profoundly homesick. In fact, I was actually cycling my legs at night, falling asleep, dreaming that I was running back to New Jersey. So I was in a bit of an emotional crisis that summer of 73, even though I'd served already in the project for several years and had actually had several phantom summers already in New Mexico, but it was just sort of a reaction I was going through. So my dad left the house there in White Rock one day, and I called my mother in New Jersey. And this was 3 weeks after we had arrived. I'm estimating about 3 weeks. And I reached her. But the paradox is that even though it was 1973 in White Rock, New Mexico, it was the fall of 1971 back in at our home in Morris Plains, New Jersey. And when my mother took that call in 1971, she picked up the phone off the fireplace in the living room, walked into the kitchen, and looked down into the rec room where we would be playing on a rainy day or a snowy day. And I was down in the middle of the rec room, lost in the reverie of playing by myself. And I looked up, and my mom was talking to me on the phone. I heard her saying, you can't be in New Mexico, son, because you're right here in the house with me. Now, when I thought about this, I thought, wait a minute. How did my call tunnel through from 1973 to 71? Because we moved from that house in November of 1972 when my dad's employer, which was the Ralph M. Parsons Company, moved from its headquarters from New York City to Los Angeles on its way to Pasadena, California, where it's still located. So apparently what happened was when we were jumping from 1971 to 73, we weren't going from A to B. We were going from A to A prime. In other words, from the 1971 timeline to a variant of that 1971 timeline that from the perspective of that 1971 timeline was dislocated a year and a half into the future. In other words, from the fall of 71 into the beginning of the summer of 73. Because think about it. When we then went back to 71, and actually 3 weeks later after we arrived, my mother took that call, and I was down in the rec room when she came up to the kitchen door and was talking to me from the future on the phone, right? But we then lived out 1971 and 72, again, spending a phantom summer of 72 in New Mexico and then jumping back to the beginning of the summer of 72 in New Jersey. But ultimately, we moved to California in November of 72. And when we re-experienced 1973 in California, my dad was at his job at the Ralph M. Parsons Company. And that summer, you know, I was going to the beach with my brothers and jumping in and out of, you know, kids' swimming pools and stuff and just having my first summer in sunny Southern California. And we were not in New Mexico, so they were different 1973s. They were different timelines in which right. the relative time-space coordinate was 1973. So I think that shows that we weren't actually tunneling through with the teleporter from A to B. Of course, we were doing it sometime in real time, but when we were doing it with a displacement of time, it wasn't to the same time in the past or future that we had lived or were destined to live. It was kind of like an emanation from the alpha timeline. And that remains a mystery to me, actually, how that all falls together. But I really should have either received, when I placed that call from 1973 in New Mexico, because we had moved in November of 72, I should have either received a disconnect signal
yeah,
or whoever had been reassigned the phone number. But notwithstanding that fact, I reached my mom in the fall of 1971.
So, I wonder if that has something to do with the, just off the top of my head, if it has something to do with the power of the mind, your intention, the power of your intention was to call your mother. And, you know, therefore the call went through. I don't know. It's a conundrum. We're going to have to go to a break, though. So we're going to have to go for a quick break. We'll be back in a few minutes. We'll catch you guys on the other side.
If you suffer or know someone that suffers from back pain, knee pain, or any other chronic or sports-related pains, you need to visit LapingoProducts.com. Dealing with pain can affect every aspect of your life, which is why our products are designed to bring you real relief. Our products are not only easy to use, effective, and safe for the entire family, but our prices are competitive and offer a complete satisfaction guarantee. Visit LapingoProducts.com, real life solutions for pain-free living.
AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is your gateway to over 500 products ranging from herbs to pain relief products, health and well-being. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is dedicated to educating and empowering you to make the best possible informed decisions about what products you can use to improve your health and well-being. Visit AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com and bring about change in your life.
And we're back. So, Andy, when you go into the future, again, you're in a different timeline than our own.
Yeah, I guess when I really did some significant thinking about, you know, the database that I assembled by going back and cataloging all my experiences, I realized that. Even though we talk kind of glibly about the fact that the multiverse, you know, is a hologram that contains a set of sort of adjacent, highly similar, but ultimately discrepant multiple timelines, when you access them from your original timeline, they're not that segment of your original timeline in the past or future. You're literally jumping between timelines. Just like, you know, we would jump through vines in a forest. In other words, you know, we speak glibly of going backward and forward in time when, for example, we teleport or we were using the more exotic forms of physical time travel like plasma confinement. But you're actually accessing that time-space coordinate on another timeline. That's ultimately what I concluded had to have been going on. For example, when they sent me to Gettysburg, and I said, well, I had failed to see President Lincoln. I saw President Lincoln several other times when they were sending me via chronovisor to the site of his assassination on April 14th of 1865 at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. So I was able to see President Lincoln as he appeared in the flesh. He looked very emaciated. We now believe that he had cancer during the Civil War and would have died in a few short years had he not been assassinated. But I found that every time they sent me to the same location, for example, it changed a little bit. So I wasn't visiting the location the same timeline. I was visiting a variant of that event in an adjacent timeline. I'm certain that that's what's going on. Mm. And certainly the phone incident in White Rock establishes that, because if we had a real-time connection to 1973, having reached it, quote-unquote, for 1971, I should not have been able to reach my mother even on a solid state telephone system.
Yeah.
So I think that I think that's what was secretly uncovered by the U.S. government, is not just the existence of the multiverse, but the fact that the multiple timelines are going on simultaneously, and they found a way to tunnel through to them using different methodologies. So the example I use is, let's say you're working in a big office building. From the perspective of people in the street, they can see somebody walking along a hallway, somebody sitting in an office. But if you're one of the people in the building, you have to go through a door or break through one of the walls to find that hallway that you never walk through. You know, that's my metaphor for accessing a timeline that you don't even know exists. And in fact, chronovision, or this kind of spontaneous teleportation to another timeline, has not just occurred intentionally as the result of these time travel experiments that the U.S. government has undertaken. I've gathered accounts of spontaneous incidents involving chronovision that people have experienced. Sometimes a sudden release of electromagnetic energy in an environment will create a tunneling effect where people will see through to a past or future event going on. So that's really what the fundamental secret that's been held back from humanity is, that from our own individual perspective, we're in a huge hologram made entirely of light in which alternate versions of the same events are going on simultaneously.
And isn't that
time travel is simply a way of accessing one of the other timelines?
And isn't that why they eventually ended up scrapping the Chronovision program, because it was just not getting any actionable or reliable information?
Well, they made a decision to – I was at the meeting. It was held at the Sandia Auditorium in the summer of 71. Of course, at the end of that summer of 71, my dad and I would jump back to New Jersey and relive that whole summer of 1971 over again. So the question is, which summer of 1971 was it? But in that summer of 1971 that we spent via quantum displacement in New Mexico, I was at the meeting in the evening with my father, and Connie Chavez was invited as his guest as well as myself. And there were about 30 project engineers there. And a man who looked a lot like J. Allen Hynek, I think it may have been J. Allen Hynek. In fact, one of the theories I have is that J. Allen Hynek's UFO research may have been a cover for his work as the consulting astronomer and one of the project principals on Project Pegasus. I'm not saying that because I'm concerned that people might consider that too farcical, like I'm trying to get too many people into my story and confabulating my story. But at least it was somebody who resembled Hynek, a serious, scholarly man with a black Van Dyke beard, came to the podium and said, I know that all of you are going to, or most of you are probably going to be somewhat disenchanted with what I'm now going to announce, but we've decided to shut down time travel to the past involving children with the chronovisors, because every time — this is a direct quote — he said, every time we send the same child or another child to the same past event, it changes a little bit. And therefore, although we can use this methodology to gather information about the past, it's not intelligence that we can rely upon. And so, for example, when they were sending me to the site of President Lincoln's assassination, they would put me down via chronovision in the muddy street outside of Ford's Theater. I would walk inside the building. There was a table there with two men who were taking tickets, and I had been coached to tell them that my parents had already been seated, and they had already provided my ticket, and could I just go past the ticket desk and be seated myself. I would then walk across the lobby, and rather than going into the theater, I'd been tasked with the mission to walk up the staircase and try to get behind the Lincoln's balcony seating to see who shot him. Was it John Wilkes Booth? Was it Major Rathbone? Was it even Mrs. Lincoln pulling a Derringer out of her purse, as it were? But she was known to carry a small weapon in her purse. And yet every time I went to the ticket desk or walked across the lobby, you know, it was Ford's Theater. Our American Cousin, starring Laura Keene, was playing that night. President Lincoln had just arrived or was expected to arrive and was destined to be assassinated at Ford's Theater that night. But from my perspective, everything would slightly change a little bit. I'd walk across the lobby, for example, and that dandy that I had seen talking to a young femme fatale was now entertaining two femme fatales as he walked across the lobby. Or one time I walked across the lobby and I saw President and Mrs. Lincoln walk past me. Then I would go up to the area behind their balcony seating. Sometimes I would be shooed away by a guard. Sometimes I would get hold of the door and it wouldn't open. Another time I would grab the door and I opened it and walked behind where President and Mrs. Lincoln were sitting. And so I wasn't visiting the same night at Ford's Theater that Lincoln got assassinated. I was, in fact, visiting that same event in a multiple series of timelines. And so they thought, wait a minute, we're not sending these children to the past or future on our timeline. Chronovision is doing something else. It's tunneling through the multiverse and identifying an arbitrary timeline where that same event is going on, but it's a slight variation of that fundamental event. So the major things remain the same. President Lincoln and Mrs. Lincoln were always arriving. It was always Ford's Theater. It was always April 14th of 1865 on that timeline, and he was always assassinated there that night. But the smaller elements were constantly changing, and it was the smaller elements that they were looking for as an intelligence-gathering program. Was that a gun in that man's holster or a tool? What was that person probably saying when they walked by speaking a foreign language? What did that person shout suddenly? In other words, in intelligence work, you're trying to derive specific information of a very subtle and sometimes transitory nature that will reveal something profound. And so every time they sent the same child to another child to the same event, all those little details would change a little bit. It was sort of like a kaleidoscope of the same event. And so they decided to shut down time travel to the past involving Chronovision in midsummer of 1971, because while they were gathering intelligence, it wasn't actionable intelligence. It was just another version of the same past event.
So if we're going into the future, and it's not really our future that we're going to, because it's obviously going to be a slight change, then how does that affect us, or how does that give us any insight into the future?
Well, that's another one of the mysteries of my experiences, and I was called to task by Starfire Tor, the writer, about this, and I think she misunderstood what I've been talking about for several years here. Project Pegasus was doing different forms of remote sensing in time in the past and future. Now, I've talked about the fact that they were able to develop a predictive capability, because I was given a set of future events that have come true, or developments, as it were, and also the identities of the last five or six presents I know that they knew to a predictive certainty. I don't know how that's the case, because certainly with the Chronovision, they were getting variant timelines in the multiverse. They may have found with teleportation that they were able to jump the person on the same timeline, the metaphor there being just like if you were to run through multiple rooms, you'd still be, you know, like the, let's say, the doors inside of hotel rooms. If you went into one adjacent hotel room after another, as long as they were in a line, you were still in the same hotel. You were still in the same timeline. So it may be that one of the quantum access technologies they discovered was giving them the actual past or future of this timeline. So, for example, if they sent somebody or anybody, a second, a third, a fourth person, to January 20th, 2009 in Washington, D.C., Barack H. Obama was always being sworn in as President of the United States. But I know that they knew the identity of Presidents Carter, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, because I met the Bushes and Obama and derived an understanding of their awareness that they were destined to be president. And references were made multiple times in my presence to President Carter and President Clinton. So I know they were able to predict the presidents, and that means that by the time I left the project in 1972, because those future presidents had already been spoken of by name, at least Presidents Carter, I met the Bushes, and then President Bill Clinton's name came up several times. By 1972, they clearly had a methodology to predict the actual future that we're destined to live on this timeline. Some of the other events they knew about were the emergence of AIDS, the advent of the Internet was spoken of in my presence when I was a child on the project. The 9/11 event was something they had gathered moving images of that my father and I viewed at the Aerojet Corporation facility in Socorro, New Mexico. And they also knew about the Watergate crisis and President Nixon's resignation from office only a few years later in 1974. So that's one of the conundrums of my experience, is that while some of the quantum access technologies and time travel technologies were sort of sampling the multiverse, certainly by 1972, they had a predictive capability to know what is going to happen on this timeline.
Well, I'm kind of curious, though, if they knew some of the future events, would they not try to maybe change them?
Well, that was something that came up when I was a child on the project. And, for example, Bob Beckwith launched into a little soliloquy about that. He was one of the consulting engineers to Project Pegasus shortly after he left General Electric and before founding his own company, Beckwith Electric Company. And when that subject would ever come up, in fact, what had happened was I had asked at the lunch, why is an engineering company like my dad's employer, the Parsons Corporation, then known as the Ralph M. Parsons Company, why is Parsons involved? And Mr. Beckwith said, well, you see, son, because we're ultimately going to get involved in quantum engineering. We're going to be changing the future for the better based on prior knowledge of it. And when he said that, everybody at the table scowled and kind of groaned, because it was clear to me, and I later interpreted, that there was certainly a consensus within the people on the project, and this was actually in some of our lecture components as kids on the project, that their capability to look into the future and predict future events would not be used to try to engineer events in the time-space continuum and for better or worse, presumably for the better, but merely to allow the executive branch of the United States to engage in contingency planning for future events and not play God, as it was discussed when I was on the project. Now, I've thought about that, and I realized there's also a practical dimension to that, and that is that if you're engaged in time travel, primarily as an intelligence-gathering activity, if you change the present based on foreknowledge of it, then the problem is you diminish the quality of your database derived from quantum access. So you have to decide, are you going to model future events, you know, send people there, generate holographic images of them and so forth, to know what's going to occur there and prepare for it? Or are you going to constantly sample the future, change it, and then diminish the quality or what you know about the events that come after the changed event? So I think that it's clear that they decided to do the former. They thought, well, the greatest use of this technology will be allow us to prepare for the future. We'll make the philosophical and religious decision not to play God and alter the future, and in so doing, we'll preserve the optimum quality of our intelligence database about future events. The other model would have been to constantly sample the future, send people there, or alter conditions in the present to divert future events. But then once they actively began changing the course of human destiny doing that, they then had to endeavor with even more passion, more intent and focus to try to speed up and figure out what happened after that changed event in the future. So I'm confident that they chose to simply look into the future. If they sent somebody there, send them on the basis of the prime directive, don't try to change anything, be very... hold back, don't bring anything back from the future unless it's intelligence that's been prepared for us on the project. If we modeled a future event with the holograms produced by the chronovisors, we won't then, we'll just derive intelligence. We won't derive operational planning based on foreknowledge of a future event. And there's also an inherent conundrum of the interpolation of a changed future. If you do determine that you're going to try to change it once you know what you see, you kind of get into a chicken and the egg phenomenon of circular causation. So I think that because of the complexities of that, they thought, we'll just use this to try to make everybody as safe as possible and not play God. And that's what I think they've done.
And there's I got a question. There's also a moral dilemma here. If the president had prior knowledge of their presidency through intelligence given to them, then there could be a preparatory program put into place to sort of guide the intelligence agency could guide future presidents in fulfilling that role as president. I mean, through giving them information, knowledge, education, insight.
Yes, there indeed is a moral dimension, and let me clarify here. Between just observing the future and gathering intelligence about it and actively trying to change the future based on prior knowledge of it, I think the best expression of what I believe they have done as standing policy is actually in some cases operate on the margin between those two approaches, because to be sure that the information I encountered in childhood and later indicated that they're not just identifying future U.S. presidents, but they're apprising them of their destinies. I don't know if they're training them. And I don't know if, for example, they're giving them staff people to get them elected. In other words, if they can identify a Barack Obama as they did. When I met President Obama, we were 20 years old. Well, it was clear from that encounter that he and even some of his friends in the anti-apartheid movement knew that he was going to be president. Now, that's knowledge. I don't know if they then trained him or guided him to his position.
Would you mind telling that story?
Sure. And I think that expresses what – also, of course, there's the, there, their prior notification to me about my Mars findings. I think they've been operating on the margin of quantum interpolation of future events, future information in the lives of the participants. We know that's been going on. Now, whether they're then trying to bring future events about as a result of knowing who's going to be involved in those events, that's data that I don't have. That's maybe the data that Dan Rather was going to be collecting about President George W. Bush when he went in search of what President Bush was doing in 1973 and lost his anchor chair at the CBS News as a result. But I met President Barack Obama in the spring or summer of 1982 when I was an undergraduate at the University of California at Los Angeles. I had been having a conversation of a political nature with an anti-apartheid activist from South Africa who was had a card table out and was pamphleteering on Bruin Walk, which is a walkway on the UCLA campus where people basically pamphleteer regarding different political issues. They distribute their literature and so forth. And I was talking to this South African named John. He had blonde, curly hair, I remember, about a variety of issues. He was lobbying for divestment by the University of California from South Africa as a way of fighting apartheid in South Africa. And I was sharing with him some of the views about different issues in law and policy regarding the transnational corporations that had been shared with me when I interviewed the futurist Buckminster Fuller back in October of 1981. And I was just describing some of the things Fuller had discussed during my, actually it was a 6-hour interview over 2 days. And I was really, I became engrossed in Fuller's thinking because I had the opportunity to interview him and just be inspired by such a brilliant individual. And so I was sort of obsessed about Bucky's thinking there for a year or so. And I said, yeah, Fuller's stating that that the CIA is raising an entirely mercenary army in Pakistan. And the South African said, really? Well, that's an unusual comment. Well, listen, you've got to come with me to my house I'm renting in West Los Angeles and meet my guest, because he was just in Pakistan. And I'm sure he'd be fascinated with what Fuller told you about Pakistan and some of Fuller's ideas about the direction that the transnational corporations are headed in. And these were just the standard issues regarding the environment and labor and, you know, wages and social conditions that later became expressed, let's say, in a book like When Corporations Rule the World by David Corton. I mean, this was the early 1980s, and people were really starting to think about, well, yeah, what kind of impact are these non-political organizations called corporations going to have on political economy and world order? And so we drove in his VW Bug from lot 6 there on the UCLA campus over to the area near San Vicente Boulevard and Bundy, for your listeners who are familiar with West Los Angeles. And we went into the home that he was renting, and I stood in the kitchen, and his house guest walked out from one of the bedrooms and introduced himself. And he said that his name was Barack Obama. And I know that it was President Obama because I actually questioned him about his rather unusual name. I have an unusual surname, and so I commented about his unusual name, and he discussed the fact that his father was from Kenya and that he was Barack Obama Jr. and so forth. Now, we then had about a half-hour discussion about some of Fuller's ideas. Barack Obama asked me about what Fuller had said about Pakistan, and he said, I don't know why Fuller said that, because I don't think that's happening. He described his recent trip there. Now, of course, that trip was undertaken at a time when there was a ban, and it was illegal for U.S. citizens to visit Pakistan. So we think that President Obama may have visited Pakistan on his Indonesian passport, which he may have retained from childhood or even updated in adolescence. But nonetheless, he described how he'd just been to Pakistan. And then we returned to this issue of the corporations that I've been discussing with his friend from South Africa, and our conversation became kind of heated. I was taking more of a socialist position on the corporations that a Bucky Fuller or a Scott Nearing or a David Corton might espouse. And Barack Obama, who ended up becoming president, was pursuing a much more doctrinaire, sort of Harvard Law School kind of defense of the transnational corporations, how they were necessary to involve people in joint enterprises and this kind of thing. And as our conversation began to unravel into something of an argument, his friend intervened and said, listen, Andy, you better be nice to him because he's going to be president of the United States someday. And at that time, I wasn't thinking about my experiences as a child in Project Pegasus and the fact that the U.S. government had achieved a time travel capability that gave them knowledge of future events, including who would become president. And I said something flippant, like, oh, well, maybe we'll pitch against each other during the same game of this, you know, the seventh game of the same World Series or something like that. And then Barack Obama smiled and began walking up the stairwell inside the house, the internal stairwell. And then I turned to his friend, and his friend grabbed sort of my shirt and said, no, and came closer to me and said, no, you don't understand, Andy. And he pointed up to Barack Obama as he was walking up the steps and said emphatically, we know he's going to be president of the United States. And when he said that, Barack Obama looked down at us and shook his head sort of affirmatively, sort of confident, like, you betcha I'm going to be president of the United States. Now, that was the second of three future presidents that I met personally, two of whom showed prior knowledge of their presidencies. The other was an encounter that my father and I had.
Andy?
With,
We've got a caller if you're willing to take one.
Certainly, right.
Okay, we've got Brett from CA, from California, on line B2.
Hello, Andy. Brett.
Yes.
How are you doing?
Good, Brett.
Do you have a question for Andy?
So far the show is going great. I didn't mean to interrupt it.
It's okay.
I was just thinking back about the bismuth and everything and the travel and the traveling and stuff.
Right. This is Brett Stillings. Brett, let me just explain your involvement in the story. Brett Stillings is an individual who I met in the summer of 1980 when my father and I were camping near Mount Shasta in Northern California. And Brett is the son of a Lockheed engineer who our fathers intentionally introduced us, we believe, because we were both known to be in the future time travel timeline. So, Brett, why don't you tell the listeners why you think my recitation of bismuth is significant, and also what your father said to you on that trip up to Shasta from your home in Southern California.
All right. Well, for one, I believe that there's a talk about, you know, bismuth being octaves above bismuth, and you know, when you get into octaves, I believe there's 9 octaves. And as you increase the energy level and the proton energy level, bismuth has 7 energy levels. You have 2, 6, 12, 8, 22, 32, 1. And as you add another, as you add 32, you push another proton into the next higher energy level of the eighth, into the eighth energy level, which is Bob Lazar's element 115, and you do it. You do so again, adding 32, and you arrive at 147. And but what gravity tends to do, or what they're learning, mainstream science hasn't really even really admitted that gravity propagates as a wave, and certainly hasn't admitted that that it propagates instantly. But gravity tends to hang around the electron shell of the atom, or tends to propagate towards. And as it does, it you know, it bends and goes elsewhere. The that's where the lensing effect comes into play. So one of the thinking, or one of the along the lines of the thinking, is that the that a gravity wave is also used to propagate the field. And to be able to see past and future events. The one of the other things is that as you arrive at higher elements, they also take on interesting properties. they also become, as you get on the octaves, they also geometrically stable. That they're, you know, bismuth actually technically shouldn't look the way it does. And technically, from what I, you know, from my own personal feelings or experiences, that it technically should be a liquid, but it's not. It's what it is, and it has very peculiar properties, or high diamagnetic strength, and so on.
Yeah, Scott and Tom, if I might just, I don't want to take over the host role here, but Brett contacted me about a year ago after he heard me on radio, and I just would like to ask him a couple questions because he's an important primary witness in my account. Brett,
okay.
When I spoke of bismuth as the crystal in the chronovisor, should I, as a non-physicist, have known that?
No, it's not really any element that anyone really would ever pick. It's if it were a fabricated story, there's many other different elements that picked, 120, 119 others. There's really no way that in your testimony, you described a crystalline structure of bismuth, and that comes up. There's an oscillation or resonance to that you start getting special properties, and that's a natural, like in the Egyptian hieroglyphs. There's certain structures that show the square structure that keeps turning in on itself incrementally, displays like an oscillation. And bismuth is also an oscillator. If you look at the elements on the periodic table, as John Searle and John Searle's team has pointed out, that elements fall within quantum states of oscillators and rotors. The oscillating elements are elements 1, 3, lithium, 5, 7, 9, on up. They're the odd numbered elements. Rotors are element number 2, number 6, number 10, number 14. And then you get into combinations of rotor oscillators, which are elements 4, 8, 12, 16.
If I might interject, so when I stated, for example, on Coast to Coast AM on November 11th of 2009, that the crystal array in the chronovisor was made of a crystalline bismuth structure, this, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't this something that was not only not in the public domain and not spoken of by conventional quantum physicists, but wasn't this something that was not even really at that time emergent in alternative time travel research and development of today?
No, it's not even recognized even now.
This was something that I had learned from my dad when I was a child on the project. He said, we're driving an EM signal through an octagonal array of bismuth. But I want to actually ask, before I turn it over back to you, to Scott as the host, I want to ask Brett one more question. When you drove up to Mount Shasta in that summer of 1980 and met my father and I, and of course your father, Tom Stillings, let me just ask you a few questions. Didn't I identify, for example, the hat and the glasses he was wearing?
Yeah.
The color of your van and so forth. Okay. When you were driving up there, didn't your father describe something about my past or future that involved time travel? Is that true?
He very specifically said when I was standing to the left of him and you're in front, and he said that to your father that, well, he is going to be the one that's going to start talking, and he laughed and he said a lot, and he's going to write about it, in fact. And I hadn't gotten to that part of knowing anything like about writing the book. And my father was always kind of kind of sarcastically saying something if he was trying to drive a point home. And your father responded in a kind of a safe, secure. He took like a safe, secure stance, didn't, just kind of gave a uh-huh, you know, like a, just didn't say much after that. And there was a couple of things said, and pause, your father went to the car to go get something, and that's when my father ushered me over to hand him the material that I gave him.
So Andy's father gave a wink and a nod.
Yeah, here you have two kids from Southern California. There's this clandestine meeting set up by their fathers in the summer of 1980 in Mount Shasta. Brett has described how driving up there, his father said something to the effect of, you're going to be meeting a young man here who was involved in time travel research by the United States government. And then at the meeting, Brett, if I might describe this, because I remembered that, Brett called me in, I think, December of last year after hearing me on Coast to Coast AM in November, and I remembered them. I described how his father was wearing a hat, kind of like one of those Australian bush hats that's kind of bent over to the side. He had sunglasses on, but they were clip-ons over his prescription eyeglasses. And I mentioned how I described the unusual pumpkin-colored color of their automobile, of their van. But the really remarkable thing that I remembered about that camping trip was that Brett's father sent him back to the van to get a shoebox. Brett brought the shoebox over to our campsite, and they had a piece that was about the size of, I don't know, about the size of a piece of bread, a slice of bread, of what his father described as boundary layer material. And he took the material, which is a sort of a slab of rock or a metallic kind of substance, and he placed it 3 feet above the campground, you know, above the dirt of the campground, and it hovered. So apparently one of the scientific purposes of that arranged meeting was to introduce me and Brett, presumably, I don't know if he had seen it before, to boundary layer materials. In other words, this is a material where you have a complete proton shell, and the ground and the rock were mutually repelling each other. And our fathers were literally showing their progeny, you know, the next generation, materials that can be used to create anti-gravitic craft. And this is 30 years ago.
Now, Brett, and you do you remember that?
Oh, I remember the it wasn't quite the size of a piece of bread, but it was slightly curled up. It was kind of like a thick piece of or a piece of sheet metal type.
Yeah.
And it was I'd played with that before. And that was only when my father was around. And there's a couple extra things to that, was that my father had pulled the car around, and he'd gotten in the van, in the back seat of the van, and was doing something. There's probably more to that. And
I
trailed off at that point, but I saw it was actually about 2 or 3 inches above the ground, and I specifically remember that.
And I remember Tom Stillings, Brett's father, urging me to look down, you know, get down on the ground and look at the fact that it was hovering. And so, you know, here you have his dad's working for Lockheed, my dad's at Parsons, involved in time travel.
Said, and,
you know, so just Brett's testimony corroborates my claim that my father was involved in deeply black classified defense technical development. It establishes that he was in communication with somebody involved in clandestine research at another major defense contractor, Lockheed. Brett provides the testimony that his father stated that I had been involved previously in time travel. And here we both corroborate the fact that his father had a piece of material. I remembered it sort of more as a slab-like material, but that he had this piece of metal that was literally repelling gravity. And so I really thank Brett, you know, for coming forward and essentially as a whistleblower and corroborating my account, you know, because it took me 10 years to get to this point where I've had the opportunity to appear in the mass media, and individuals like Brett are now coming forward and corroborating different parts of my account. And I'm very grateful for that.
All right.
Wow,
absolutely.
Thanks a lot. I actually have another question for you, Brett. Were you aware of your father's research and what he was involved in, or did he keep it pretty close to the chest?
Well, I knew that there was always, you know, stuff I couldn't ask in front of company, like how would something like this work, or couldn't say this. And at school, you know, young age, you can't say where Dad works. He's a mathematician. It was about all you could really say. He got into Lockheed Skunk Works. I can't remember what year it was, but he'd worked at JPL. He worked at Bendix first, and he worked at JPL, and then he upgraded to Lockheed. And from what everyone tells me, is that when you say Skunk Works, you're basically saying Area 51. I've heard these stories about John Lear but John Lear like stories. I heard one where someone had to wear goggles on the way out, and I do remember a very specific story where my dad was glad that he didn't have to wear those things anymore, and my dad had a really insecure thing about his eyes, and I think because he mentioned that he had to walk out of a building to another building, but he had to wear something, and he didn't like wearing it. And wow. When I heard a goggle story, very much a similar story like that, it just completely pinged to me.
Right, you remember that. Well, I gotta thank you for coming on the show and backing up Andy's story. I'm sure that we'll be hearing more from you in the future in regards to Andy. Now, thanks for your call. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I do have some more questions for Andy.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Andy?
Yes.
Well, that was amazing. Having somebody call in to back up your story while you're on the air, that's amazing.
Yes.
And you have other people that are backing you up, don't you?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I had an ethicist for the intelligence community, Jean Marie Arrigo, provide me access to Captain Ernest Garcia. I think he's now Major Ernest Garcia, who confirmed that he remembered my father. He asked me, do you remember Connie Chavez? Because the project people were frequently dining at the restaurants where she worked in Albuquerque. And he remembered the project. Of course, he had worked as a guard on the Dead Sea Scroll expedition of the Israeli archaeologist Yigal Yadin in the 50s. And also, he was the whistleblower on the human rights abuses involving the Yanomamo Indian tribe in Central America, where the U.S. Defense Department was involving them in highly unethical experiments involving chemical and biological weapons. So he was very guarded, but he did confirm for me that Project Pegasus existed, that it involved Triple T, as he said, time travel technologies. And he even remembered interviewing me at Camp Kilmer in New Brunswick, New Jersey, when I was a five-year-old, just being brought into the project. So, you know, but just by simply doing enough background investigation, I've had people like Gene and Brett contact me and share things from my past where I can go, oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, your dad was wearing that Breaker Morant hat. You had this pumpkin-colored van. He pulled this weird material out of a shoebox and showed how it was hovering, you know, above the ground. So I've developed corroboration that way by simply talking enough about what happened to me so then people contact me. In some cases, I've been put in touch with through academics with people inside the military and intelligence community who have shared certain information with me. For example, early in my investigation, my name and my father's name were found in the entry logs for the Los Alamos National Labs and the Alamogordo Air Force Base. And when we asked CIA what they could provide about my father, the word that came back through our intermediary, that is to say me and the academic I was working through who's liaising for me to ONI and to CIA, is we cannot provide any information to the immediate family members of living or deceased CIA personnel. You know, when I contacted certain project principals like Dr. Harold Agnew, who was the administrator of the project, When I spoke with Joseph Connison, who was one of my father's colleagues from the Ralph M. Parsons Company, who was one of the electrical engineers on Project Pegasus, they provided information that established that the project existed and that it involved teleportation-based time travel and other forms of quantum access. When I told Joe Connison, for example, that I was going to be writing a book and trying to get a movie made, a feature film about my experiences, he said, and this is a direct quote, he said, "A book, a movie, nobody on the outside knows about that stuff." When I first contacted Dr. Agnew in 2000, he said, "No, look, Andy, you're mixed up here. You're mistaken. The teleportation project wasn't at LANL." Well, it wasn't. In New Mexico, it was based at Sandia. Now, that's in the law what we call an admission against interest. It reveals the knowledge of something that implicates the person in what you're talking about, what you're conjecturing happened. So I'm going to be describing statements made by scores of individuals that established that this project existed. In fact, that's why I took the long view here. I was playing the long game. I knew if I gave it 10 years, I'd find enough people who would corroborate as either primary or secondary witnesses the mere fact that the project existed, which really is going to force a paradigm shift in our thinking about what the U.S. government was involved in the latter half of the 20th century.
That's right, because you took 10 years and did trips to Mexico to corroborate your story and go over and talk to people and get testimony and all this information before you ever came out and spoke about it, didn't you?
Yeah, let me just give one other example. These examples are just at random. I haven't even prioritized them because I have dozens of confirming statements from project principals. Let me just describe Ivan Browning. I had remembered a lunch that I had attended in New Mexico, again, at one of these famous Mexican restaurants in Old Town Albuquerque, which were then the leading Mexican restaurants, they probably still are, in New Mexico. And that was sort of where the project principals would have lunch or dinner and then maybe drift off to a bar and continue the conversations. I was involved literally probably in 100 such meals with my father and the other engineers from Parsons, with Dr. Agnew. Sometimes some of the other Manhattan Project physicists were there. Edward Teller, Dr. Sterling Colgate from New Mexico Tech was at some of those meals. And I was literally hanging out as a child with the U.S. physicists and science administrators and electrical engineers who were creating a time travel capability for the U.S. government. So I had remembered meeting Dr. Ivan Browning at a lunch. Browning had served as the director of the Directorate of Science and Technology for the CIA between 1959 and 1974. I remembered the fact that my father had corrected himself and said, "Oh, Ivan, I didn't realize your name was Ivan. I thought it was Ivan." And then I remembered Dr. Browning explaining, "Yes, my mother was Norwegian, so my family spelled my name Ivan with the Norwegian spelling of Ivan." So I did some research on Ivan Browning, and I first found his daughter, Evelyn Browning Garris. And when I asked her directly whether your father was overseeing an incipient time-space exploration program under DARPA, in other words, when he was Director of Science and Technology for CIA, did he have any purview to the CIA's oversight of their part of Project Pegasus? Because, of course, we were deriving intelligence that was then forwarded in reports to CIA, and we were involved in an intelligence program. And I had found previously that my father was essentially the point man between Parsons and the CIA on the project. And she clammed down and said, "Well, maybe in the future someday I can confirm or deny your question." So she basically clammed up. I then went to the individual who I researched, and I found that he was holding 60 or more of Ivan Browning's residual patents. Ivan Browning is deceased. I found Dr. John Pierce working right here in Vancouver, Washington, where I reside. And I had several very informative lunches with John Pierce. And I started sharing some of the technical terms that I remembered from the time travel experiences that I was directly involved in on the project. I remembered, for example, that when the holograms of the chronovisors would collapse, we would find ourselves immersed for about 90 seconds in a field of supercharged particles called scintillation. And I said, John, is that a technical term? Is that from the realm even of quantum physics? And he said, yes, scintillation describes the properties of supercharged particles performing in a certain way. And again, I'm not a physicist. I'm not even a scientist. I am a lawyer and a former journalist. I did a very limited course of studies in science as a college student and graduate student. Mostly in math and natural history subjects related to my environmental law course of studies. I'm well educated. I have a number of degrees, but I am not a scientist. So here I find the person holding the residual patents of one of the project people I remembered interacting with at lunch was confirming the validity of different technical terms I was sharing from the project in the same way that Brett Stillings just confirmed that there's no way I should have even been talking about bismuth as the element from which the crystal array in the chronovisor was made. So then I learned that Browning had done a series of climate change studies for the CIA. He had directed a kind of a study group that was exploring whether the greenhouse effect would ultimately pitch us into global cooling, basically a new ice age, along the lines of the premise presented by Art Bell and Whitley Strieber in The Coming Global Superstorm, that once there's enough melting, there'll be a dilution of the oceans, the Gulf Stream will fail to continue to bring warm water from the equatorial regions up to the polar regions, and we'll suddenly have a cold snap like your freezer freezing over on a hot July day when you have enough melting of the ice in the refrigerator. And I was lucky to find Cliff Harris, who was one of those climatologists working under Dr. Browning. I found him through the good graces of Robert Felix, the Ice Age researcher. And I started to narrate everything I've narrated in my radio interviews about the teleporters, the chronovisors, all the different forms of quantum access and time travel that I was involved in as a child in Project Pegasus. And Cliff literally stopped me on the phone and he said, Andy, you don't want to talk about this on the phone. This stuff remains classified. You may be getting yourself in some danger here. I can confirm that in the early 1970s, when you say you were a child on the project, I was doing the CIA's Ice Age studies with Ivan Browning. In fact, I was the youngest person. On that team. And he was talking all the time about what Project Pegasus was doing. He was describing how time travel had been achieved, how people were teleporting across the country and back, and that the project had already begun to involve children in the time travel experiences that the devices allowed. So here we have a principal climatologist for CIA who worked directly with Browning, who after I contacted with him, remembering the lunches that we shared with Ivan, confirmed that Ivan stated corroborated what I would later say Project Pegasus had achieved. Now that's hearsay. That's basically an out-of-court, statement, a secondary statement offered to prove the truth of the matter that I'm asserting, that Project Pegasus developed time travel technologies.
Right. Unless he was nice enough to sign an affidavit.
Well, perhaps he will in the future, but my point is, secondary corroboration like that, which in a court of law would be hearsay evidence, is the kind of evidence that social science research in general is made of. I mean, when Margaret Mead came back from Samoa, and she said what the Samoans do, we didn't require affidavits from the Samoans. We relied on her status as a PhD, as an academician, and we were relying on her integrity of what she learned or what the Samoans told her about their culture. Okay, I'm doing the same thing. I'm going out in American culture, and I'm coming back with these secondary accounts, and in some cases primary accounts like Brett's, that he met me, that his father revealed to him that, that we had the encounter with the boundary layer material that weekend, and our fathers both worked for major defense contractors involved in secret work for the U.S. government. But my point here is that I'm not trying to prove a legal case. I'm performing social science research. I'm going back and trying to tell the history of one of the most significant secret projects ever developed, maybe the most significant secret project ever undertaken by the U.S. government, and that was the project under DARPA to literally give the U.S. government a time travel capability that 40 years later remains secret. So I stand by these secondary accounts because they're good enough for any other form of social science research.
Given that, now, I mean, there's been some time passed since you've been in the program. Who knows where they could be at with this technology today. What would you like to see within of that technology today and now?
Well, I'm kind of trying to inspire society by talking about what the project achieved, and I'm also kind of framing a warning. The inspiring thing is that, look, we're going to be going from 7 billion people on this planet to 9 billion by 2045. The world may not be overpopulated in a total sense, but certainly the urban areas are highly congested. You know, with people literally spending several hours a day commuting from their residence to their place of employment. That's going to become more and more difficult by simply trying to add another lane to the freeway, because every time, for example, that's done in California, it fills up with cars. You know, I read one study that indicated that if the people of China adopt a U.S. standard of living to include two cars per family, there's going to be enough global warming just produced by those emissions from those Chinese cars to possibly tilt the global environment out of balance, and we'll have flooding in every coastal city on the planet. And that's disturbing, not in and of itself, but because of the fact that 70% of humanity lives within a one-hour car drive of an ocean. So we can't have that happen if we want to save civilization. So on the level of inspiration, I'm trying to communicate the idea that, look, this project developed teleportation that was fully operational and functional for human beings. Yes, there was a grievous accident in which one of the children in the project lost his feet teleporting to Santa Fe, but people lose their feet underneath 16-wheelers. They lose their feet under the dash of their automobile when they're involved in some kind of tragic accident. All forms of transportation involve danger. What we know about teleportation is it will allow for, particularly for long-distance transport of human beings, that is faster, easier on the traveler, less costly, and less environmentally destructive. It'll basically involve an order of magnitude improvement on the ability to get somebody from point A to point B. Rather than getting from New York to Los Angeles, driving 3,000 miles with 4,000 pounds of metal strapped around your waist called an automobile, or flying in a commercial airliner that in the aggregate, where you have the commercial airliners putting out billions of tons of pollutants every year, we'll be able to go to teleports and jump through tunnels in the time-space continuum and pop out the other end, usually uninjured, with less time invested, more ease, less fatigue on the traveler, less cost, less environmental harm, and in a way that will involve greater safety, because there will seldom be collisions as everybody opens up a tunnel within a time-space continuum that's entirely elastic.
Mm.
Unlike automobiles or planes or trains, where you can have a collision with an object or another vehicle. Okay, so I'm waging my truth campaign not to hold the U.S. government accountable for concealing time travel, but to simply articulate on behalf of my fellow human beings around the world that here we have a solution to the crisis of global warming that's upon us. Whether we believe that crisis doesn't exist, or whether it's caused by natural factors or human factors or some combination thereof, you cannot argue with the concept that a more efficient form of transport will be more environmentally benign, even with particulates or with gaseous byproducts of conventional forms of transportation. There'll be fewer respiratory diseases. There'll be no need to pollute our lungs with asbestos fibers from our brake linings and so forth. Okay. So I'm simply trying to inspire people to consider the fact that we have solutions to the problem of environment and development that's upon us, and one major area where we have to look for those solutions is in some of the technologies that the U.S. government developed during the Cold War, during the last 60 years since the Manhattan Project, that it's kept secret because it weaponized those technologies during and after and immediately after World War II. There are other positive things that can come about through declassifying these technologies. In terms of chronovision, imagine going to a virtual library or museum where rather than looking at a painting or opening up a book to read about the signing of the U.S. Constitution, you can look at a hologram where it would be rendered in moving three-dimensional images. Why should I and the other people who were brought inside Project Pegasus be the only human beings inspired to study and appreciate history as a result of having the opportunity to see such images? Why shouldn't every school child around the world be able to see the living past by being able to go into a museum or library in their country where you can literally pull up images and see William Shakespeare writing one of his plays, or Cicero giving a speech, or the Polish infantry fighting their way up Mount Cassini during the Battle of Italy. Okay, there are a multiplicity of inspiring scenes in history that are infinitely available, perpetually available, an infinite number, to inspire society, particularly school children, in all that the human past has held. Now, with those opportunities comes obvious constraints. For example, with teleportation and other forms of time travel, we don't want to allow it to be to society at large to have general access to it, because the timelines would all become chaotic. If people could visit the past as regularly as they can go on a summer vacation, everybody's going to have an impact on the timelines, and with enough people doing that, we're going to have basically quantum chaos.
Andy?
Yes.
We're going to have to cut it short now because we're actually over our time, but that's okay. Could you give out your websites and how people can contact you or talk to you?
Right. My time travel research and the story of my quest to go back and determine what happened on Project Pegasus and bring it forward to the present is at www.projectpegasus.net, and that will continue to grow. I'll continue to put more information up there about my experiences and about time travel and describe the devices and so forth. My Mars research is at www.projectmars.net, and I'm trying to be eclectic there and just put up the best of my findings and the findings of other prominent Mars anomaly researchers. But these are two areas where the U.S. government has been concealing the nature of our cosmos from human civilization, and that's why I'm focusing on those two areas. Mars is inhabited. The NASA data from the rovers shows that in clear, convincing, and compelling evidence. And
you know, Andy, just quickly, we didn't even really get into or touch Mars, and I'd love to do that on possibly on a future show if we could do. I mean, you just have so much information that I think we could fill half a dozen shows quite easily.
Right, I'd be happy to come back, and I'm focusing on Pegasus. I need to get the book written that is completed. I'm going to soon be going into a sabbatical for my law practice to achieve that.
But yes, you're moving into a cabin in the woods, and we're going to load you up with food and nourishment and some water, and you're just going to stay in the cabin until the book's done.
Yeah, actually, it's going to be a nicer setting than that. I don't want to reveal where it is, but pledge to get the book out by middle of next year.
That was an old Facebook joke from your Facebook page. I remember
that. Yes, I know. And I'm not just trying to create drama. Really, I've just been surviving as a lawyer in solo practice. But the good news is I have the story down, so it's not going to be lost to the sands of time. I mean, the fundamental story about Project Pegasus has already been captured and is in writing. I just have to sort of weave it now into a narrative, a complete narrative. But so that's going to, 2011 is going to be the year when my book comes out and shows the world that time travel was achieved 40 years ago, and now we have to demand that the U.S. government acknowledge that it declassify teleportation, and that we begin talking about a global program of technology transfer where we can start relying on teleportation to get from point A to point B on the face of our planet in real time.
That would have a dramatic effect on humanity as a whole. Like,
absolutely.
Just the amount of things we could move to third world countries to help them through the means of teleportation, that's incredible.
Imagine a famine situation where you don't lose so much overhead in the administration of the charity, but you simply identify a staging area in an area where the famine is occurring, and you start throwing food provisions through a vortal tunnel in time-space. And the aid workers just pick up the food there and distribute it locally. That would be so much more efficient that even the inefficiency of food transport around the world would probably eliminate famine. So, yes, you know, there are all kinds of pro-social purposes of teleportation. Of course, we'd have to administer it in a controlled way, just like we administer air travel. We don't let terrorists, criminals, or three-year-olds fly airplanes, right?
No.
So the administration of teleportation would be, again, on a limited access basis, just like we would want to control chronovision, because if we didn't, there would be no more privacy left in the world. So, but we have to use these technologies basically to force the paradigm shift we're going to have to make to even survive as a planetary civilization, much less thrive in the 21st century.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you for your time, Andy, Andrew. And thank you, everybody, for listening. If you miss the show or any part of the show, you can go to www.spectrumradionetwork.com and click on the archive or past shows there, and you can listen to the full interview. You can go to BBS Radio, and you can click on the archives there. And not only would you hear this show, but you would also hear over 50,000 hours of shows, 10,000 hours with over 50 hosts. So any way you want to listen to the shows, you can listen to them in their entirety. Well, that's it for us, folks. Tom?
Yes, I want to thank you, Andy, for coming on, and hopefully we'll talk again.
Thank you. I look forward.
I look forward to it as well. Thanks, and have a great night, guys. And I'll see you next week.